is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now go to Venezuela. We are joined by Jason Tuchman. He's an instructor in political science at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He is also conducting research and consultations in Venezuela, as well as observing the elections. Welcome to the shadow, Jason. Tell me how you got to Caracas and Venezuela, and what you saw when you got there.
Well, thanks a lot, Robert. It's really good to be down here in Caracas and have the opportunity to observe the electoral process. I got down here upon invitation by the government, and they invited me to come participate in electoral observation and do some of my own research and consult with them over several of the issues that are relevant to the campaign.
Well, we've seen a highly contested election between Nicolas Maduro, the declared winner, and Enrique Capriles, who has announced that he will be challenging the results. What are the results as far as you can see?
The National Electoral Commission has announced the results upon counting 99.2% of the ballots, and their calculation is that 50.66% of voters support Nicolas Maduro, the candidate for the Chavista, for the Socialist Party of Venezuela, and that somewhere around 49.1% of those who casted their ballots did so for Enrique Capriles, the opposition candidate. The opposition candidate Capriles has not accepted the outcome as legitimate. He is challenging the counting and asserted that there have been irregularities and that that there should be 100% recount of all the ballots. It should be noted that there's an automatic process involved with the elections here in Venezuela by which 54% of the ballots that are cast are automatically recounted after the poll. So that is taking place, but he doesn't feel confident with that result, and owing to the closeness of the count by the National Electoral Commission so far, it looks like there's a legitimate claim to have all of the ballots recounted one by one, and I hope and suspect that that will happen and will allay the fears that that there's any kind of untoward behavior occurring here.
Of this alleged untoward behavior, what kinds of accusations are being made by the opposition candidate as well as the incumbent? Are supporters on both sides making complaints?
I think the allegations that there was some kind of wrongful behavior or fraudulent behavior are only coming from the opposition, from the Capriles camp. And I think it's important to recognize that the balloting that happens here in Venezuela has widely been regarded as legitimate, as well beyond the international norms of democratic processes in terms of counting ballots accurately, recording how elections take place. This has been called by Jimmy Carter, who is he publicly stated last year that after observing 92 electoral missions internationally, that Venezuela has, and these are his words, the best in the world in terms of the voting process. At the ballots, at the polling stations, there are both electronic machines and also a printout paper ballot of each voter's preference, and those are reconciled. There's both an electronic and a paper record of how people are voting in Venezuela, and those can be matched up against each other and then also recounted. So, you know, whereas we've had a lot of problems in the United States with knowing exactly how people counted and with doubts about the electoral process, this is a verifiable and legitimate process here in Venezuela, and I think a recount will show once again that the electoral process is legitimate and that there's not any kind of fraudulent behavior.
So Venezuela did not fall into the Diebold trap in as much as they have parallel paper physical audit trails of the voting.
That's right. There is a paper trail. And once voters vote, and I had the opportunity to actually go to three different polling stations yesterday and observe the process, once voters cast their vote, they push the button next to their preferred candidate. There is then a paper printout. They can look at it and make sure that if they voted for Capriles, it says Capriles. If they voted for Maduro, it says Maduro. And then they put that piece of paper into the ballot box. So there's actually several levels of verification that happens here. And I think it's quite a legitimate, transparent, and rapid process that they're taking part in here.
Can you give us some comparison between the largeness of the turnout and the length of the lines? Was there any correlation there? How did this turnout compare to prior elections, and how efficiently did it go?
It was a very efficient process. From what I saw, it took people typically about 3 to 5 minutes to go through all the different steps of voting, which includes signing in and having their identity verified, and then going to the ballot, pushing the button of their preferred candidate, getting the printout, taking that to the ballot box, putting it in, and then going and dipping their finger in the permanent ink that shows, it's permanent purple ink that shows, I mean, it goes away after a few days, but at least for the period of balloting, their finger is purple, and that verifies that they have voted and ensures that they can only vote one time. That whole process takes about 3 minutes, and then I watched it happen very, very rapidly and efficiently. There was one polling station that I went to here downtown in downtown Caracas, where there was one of the mesas, one of the tables where people were voting, where the process had gotten a bit jammed up, and there was a line of approximately what I saw to be 15 people. Some people in the front said that they had been waiting for somewhere in the realm of an hour. The line was moving, but quite slowly. But again, that was the exception to the rule. Most of the time, people are moving through much more rapidly.
Jason, can you give us a picture of what it looked like as you saw various places during the election? The type of people, the mood, the kind of activity, was there protest? Was there emotion visible? Give us a picture of what it looked like in Caracas.
Sure. Well, I witnessed three different polling locations, and the group of observers that I was with went past a fourth, and I can say unequivocally that there was no kind of protest, violence, disorder. Everything was very straightforward, transparent, and orderly. No matter who people were voting for, they seemed to be content with the process and filed through in a very orderly manner. And in fact, something that I noted with interest was that at each polling station, there was a witness with both of the political parties, that being the party of Chavismo, the Socialist Party, and the opposition for Capriles. And at each of the polling locations, there were witnesses representing the political parties observing to make sure that nothing fraudulent or inappropriate was occurring. And both of these representatives at each of the mesas that I observed were sitting there quietly, sometimes politely engaged in exchange of you know, light words with each other. But in no instance did I encounter any kind of problems or expressions by them. And I did speak to some of these witnesses representing the parties, and on no occasion did either of them say that there was a problem at that particular station.
There was a marked difference in the two different parties or candidates in regard to foreign aid, oil policy, economic policy, social justice, and relations with Cuba, and so on. Can you give us an idea of how the two paths represented by Capriles and Maduro in the wake of Chavez, how those two different paths would be different?
Well, I think domestically, Capriles' campaign has been much more focused on ensuring that that things will function in a more orderly manner, that private property will be more profoundly respected than has been under Chavez. Interestingly, there are many ways in which Capriles has also sought to embrace the socialist Chavista program, by claiming that he will maintain many of those social missions, many of those social programs that have been created under Chavez. And in fact, in many ways, and this has surprised a lot of people, including I think some of Capriles' base, is he has embraced, at least discursively, a revolutionary project. He's actually called himself on national TV, on campaign stops, a revolutionary, and challenged Maduro for not being an authentic socialist, for not actually having the credibility to maintain a Chavista program. Capriles, the oppositional candidate, has often appeared wearing a red shirt, and in many ways has, that is, of course, the color of the Socialist Party, in many ways has sought to position himself as a Chavista. And I think that it's rather incredulous, considering that, he represents many of the business interests. He campaigned last year. He ran against Chavez in 2012 in October, and he historically has a very conservative, pro-business agenda. And now, in the wake of Chavez's death, with so much sympathy for the recently deceased president, he's sought to rebrand himself as, in some cases, more Chavista than Chavez's heir, Maduro. And so I think in terms of domestic policies, he's kind of all over the place and has claimed that, he will deepen respect for private property and free market policies, but at the same time maintain the nationalization of the oil sector, of the social programs. And it's difficult to see how the two agendas could come together. I think with Maduro, what you see is very clearly plans to continue the program that Chavez initiated to maintain and deepen the social missions for housing and education. Healthcare programs that have really been instrumental in diminishing the poverty and the inequality that has historically plagued Venezuela. So I think with Maduro, it's quite likely that we'll see a great deal of continuity. With Capriles, it's uncertain what we would have seen on a domestic level. In terms of international policy, again, I think with Maduro, we can anticipate seeing continuity of programs like Petrocaribe, where Venezuela extends desirable agreements with other countries in terms of exchanging oil for sometimes domestic goods that countries produce, or providing oil in exchange for favorable conditions in terms of interest rates and paying back the loans. So I think that in terms of international policy, you would again see considerable continuity. You would see with Maduro its similar policies towards Cuba, continued supply of oil and support to Cuba, whereas Capriles has called these things into question and said that he will review all the international agreements, and I think the kind of relationship that Chavez had fostered with Cuba, the really strong ties with Cuba, would likely change in a dramatic way under Capriles' government.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're speaking with Jason Tauchman with the University of British Columbia at Vancouver's Department of Political Science, speaking with us from Caracas, Venezuela. And Jason, were there foreign influences in the Venezuelan election, whether direct, financial, clandestine, covert, or otherwise?
I guess to answer your question, I'd have to say that it's really difficult to tell what kind of international influences there are, where there are dollars that might be flowing. It seems to me that the process here, the so-called Bolivarian Revolution here in Venezuela, is very much a homespun, a domestically driven project that comes very much in the vision of Hugo Chavez. I think there's a lot of collaboration and regional integration between Venezuela and other countries. But in terms of actual influence, a question like, is Cuba influencing Venezuelan policy under Chavez or Maduro? I think that would be difficult to see how that happens, in that Chavez has moved a very distinct foreign policy, a distinct domestic agenda, and I don't see money or any kind of influence really flowing in any direction into Venezuela vis-a-vis the government. In terms of the opposition, it's really hard to know if money is coming in from I think the accusations would be that conservative interests, that conservative political organizations in the United States might be supporting the Capriles government, either in terms of financing or advice. That's a possibility, but I don't have any evidence of that.
What do you see down the road now with the apparent re-election of Nicolas Maduro, pending the recount, of course, that would affect the relations between Caracas and Washington? Where do you see that going from here?
Well, it's really hard to say how Maduro is going to position himself in relationship to the United States. There are many who think that his international relations policies might be more pragmatic, that there might be a bit of improvement in the relationship with the United States. But at the same time, there are some indications that, again, there might be continuity with the Chavez administration in that there was an action by Maduro to expel a couple of U.S. diplomats around the time of Chavez's death. And so that kind of thing could still continue, and there might still be, somewhat of a difficult spot between the two countries. So that really remains to be seen.
Jason, what should people keep their eye on in the coming days of the recount and whatever celebration or consternation may follow?
Well, I suspect that there will be a recount. I don't know if the National Electoral Commission has formally announced that will happen. But that has been demanded by the opposition candidate Capriles, and it seems like there's support from President-elect Maduro to do that. So I anticipate that should happen, and hopefully a recount that includes every ballot will be what is necessary to confirm the legitimacy of the electoral process. And I think we all hope that there's not any kind of spiral towards conflict or instability or violence that comes of that. But there seems every indication that the opposition is not willing to concede the election, and that they simply cannot conceive of another 6 years of Chavismo. So I think there might be some instability ahead of us, regardless of how the recount goes.
With much appreciation for the firsthand insights, we are speaking with Jason Tochman of the Political Science Department of the University of British Columbia at Vancouver, and he is speaking with us from Caracas, Venezuela, as a researcher, a consultant, and an observer in the wake of the elections over this weekend. And Jason, you have the last word to tell us what lessons we might draw from this, or how we might anticipate or improve the future.
Thanks, Robert. I guess what I'd encourage people to take away from the situation here in Venezuela is that, despite the rather close election where the Chavista candidate Maduro has won by 1% pending a recount, it's clear that the majority of Venezuelans have gone to the polls and supported the Socialist Party. And so I think there is a call for a continuation of the kind of policies, domestically in particular, that have improve the lives for a great number of Venezuelans, particularly the low-income, the working class. And we've seen in Venezuela poverty significantly decline between 2002 and 2011. Poverty fell by 19 percentage points, from around 49% down to 29%. Extreme poverty declined from 22% down to 12%. These are really remarkable numbers, and for many people, their lives have simply gotten better. And so I think that's why they're supporting a continuation of the socialist project. And I think also quite importantly is Venezuela, and this is not widely reported, but Venezuela actually has, with the exception of Canada and possibly Cuba, the lowest level of inequality in the entire Western Hemisphere. And, this is measured by us political scientists and as the Gini coefficient, and that number for Venezuela is actually below 0.4, which is measured between great inequality at 1 and no inequality at 0. So Venezuela is actually surpassing the United States in terms of the level of equality, and is the most equal country in terms of income in Latin America. And so we see that the socioeconomic dynamics of Venezuela changing, and I think that's meaningful to a lot of people. And in addition to poverty and inequality declining, we see economic indicators like child malnutrition down significantly by around 60%. Illiteracy has been eliminated, according to UNESCO, UN agency, in 2005. Unemployment is down, and housing for low-income people has dramatically increased. In the last 2 years, they've built over 340,000 new housing units, again, for low-income people. So I think people's lives have dramatically improved, at least for more than half of the population. And it seems that, to me, that is what is driving the continuation of support for the Chavista program and why Maduro has apparently won this election yesterday.
Jason, how can people follow your work?
Well, I publish articles online, and I also am doing a lot of academic writing. So I guess for the popular media, for a general readership, I'd suggest Googling my name and see what comes up.
Thank you so much for the insight today. Jason Tuchman of the Political Science Department of the University of British Columbia at Vancouver. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Democracy. It's coming through a hole in the air. From those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen, to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. And I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on. Sail on, O mighty ship of state. To the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on. Sail on. Sail on.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We're speaking with Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, a professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College and author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. And Miguel, I understand that you, like many of us, have been up overnight watching the election in Venezuela. What is the outcome, as far as you know, at this point in time?
Well, the outcome is Maduro is the victor of the election with a very razor-thin margin, 50.66 to 49.7. The candidate for the opposition, Mr. Capriles Radonsky, is contesting and requesting and demanding, in fact, a recount, which in Venezuela is not a very complicated matter because it's a very transparent process. It's an electronic voting process in which there's not only an electronic trail, but there's also every individual has a paper ballot that they're also given, one that they deposit and one they keep. So it should be a very relatively easy process to prove this. This is not the Mexican elections, which in which it dragged on for almost a month, or the U.S. elections, for that matter, in Florida, where they dragged on for almost a month as well.
I'm given to understand that the lines for the election booths in many places are reported to have been shorter than in previous times, say in October and elections before then. Is that because of voter disinterest or because of efficiency and technology?
Actually, it's not voter disinterest. The outcome of the turnout was high, almost 78%. So in that sense, it speaks to the rapidity and the ease with which there is to vote in Venezuela. So that was a major issue. The major issue, I think, will be simply how the different sides now grapple with this new, much closer political scenario.
One of the things that happened before the election, and however trustworthy or not, mainstream American media outlets were reporting that the sitting president, Nicolas Maduro, was leading Enrique Capriles by a margin of 10, 12 points or so, and the final outcome has boiled down to one-tenth of that. What is your analysis of that?
Well, I think that they were probably correct. I mean, if you look at data analysis, Interlaces, ICS, they all had Maduro largely in part because of the outpouring around the death of Hugo Chavez and the sympathy that many Venezuelans expressed in his death. We also have to recognize that Capriles ran a very efficient campaign and essentially targeted some of the major issues that the Chavistas have needed to address, and these include crime, inflation, food shortages. And I think that Maduro's campaign was not as efficient, not as clear in its message, and it relied too much still on the image of Chavez. And I think that those are the issues that now he has to fundamentally address. He has to now exercise leadership and authority if he plans to address these questions and be able to do so forthrightly and quickly in order to ensure that he didn't lose further support.
What were the major differences in policy between the two? One of the things about the Bolivarian movement and Chavez has been a regional alliance and economic cooperation, and we're given to understand that Mr. Capriles promised that he would have downgraded the diplomatic relationships between such nations as Cuba and others of the former Soviet bloc. Can you contrast where Venezuela might go between the two candidates?
Well, I think that if you want to simply understand where Venezuela is at today, just reflect back to 1998 before Hugo Chavez appeared on the political landscape. The reality is that Venezuela was a faithful ally of the U.S. It voted with the U.S. Almost consistently in the United Nations, the Organization of American States. It was part of the Cold War bloc. And your listeners probably would have never heard about Venezuela. That's simply the reality. They were known for maybe having oil, having a few good baseball players, and occasionally winning the meaningless Miss Universe contest. And that all dramatically changed because Venezuela was transformed in many ways, particularly because of Hugo Chavez's efforts at realigning Venezuela, recognizing its Latin American identity, recognizing its indigenous and African heritage. And in fact, President Lula of Brazil talks about one of the greatest contributions one can say about Hugo Chavez is that he reintegrated and reestablished Venezuela as a Latin American country, and given the promotion of new institutions in Latin America, particularly such as the Union of South American Nations, the Community of Caribbean and Latin American Nations, the Bolivarian Alliance for Latin America. So with Maduro, we'll see a continuity in these major issues. With Capriles, we would see a return to the pre-1998 in which Venezuela largely operated within the U.S. political orbit and essentially framed their sets of interest in regard to Washington's foreign policy.
One of the things that Mr. Capriles had indicated was that he would have changed the relationship between Venezuela and Cuba, and therein hangs a tale going back to 2002, does it not?
Sure, it does. Much of that has to do with the fact that this is an opposition that initially thought of Chavez as an aberration. They simply could not accept that Venezuela had changed. And they kept insisting that Venezuela was simply had made a mistake and that somehow it would return. So that means that the opposition did not fully participate in the electoral process. In fact, they attempted to subvert it by supporting a coup in 2002, once we know that the U.S. fingerprints were all over. They also attempted to sabotage the internal dynamics of power, of governance. And then they staged a national strike in which they attempted to shut down the oil industry. And then eventually in 2004, They recognized that the constitution that they had opposed included a recall provision there because Chavez essentially insisted on it. So this is the only country that has a recall provision for its own president. So then by 2004 and 5, they began to participate in the electoral process. But Cuba and Venezuela have a very close relationship, but this opposition sees Cuba as a detriment and would recast Venezuela's relationship with Cuba, with Latin America, with Haiti, with the Caribbean, because Venezuela is providing oil to many of these Caribbean countries at long-term credit rates and was willing to accept payment in kind, which this administration, the Capriles, had they won, would have initially subverted.
WikiLeaks State Department cables give us an insight as to that relationship. They speculate that there might have been a cooperative arrangement in which Venezuela provided oil to Cuba and Cuba medical assistance to Venezuela. And I'm recalling an incident in which Enrique Capriles, when he was the mayor of one of the districts of Caracas, was accused, either rightly or wrongly, of intervening or allowing to be assaulted the Cuban embassy. Do you know about that?
Sure. This was during 2002 when the opposition was emboldened. They staged a coup that only lasted 48 hours, but that 48 hours gave us a window really into what their program was. And it was rescinding Venezuela's relationship with OPEC, which Venezuela helped found in 1960 with Saudi Arabia. It was rescinding relationships with Cuba. And part of that was an assault on the Cuban embassy, which was in the district at that time, in which the part of the city that Capriles was governing. And many people actually assaulted the embassy, cut off the water, cut off the electricity to an embassy, which is a sovereign space. And Capriles was linked to that. And these individuals were adamant about punishing the Cubans who were inside, accusing them of collaborating or cooperating with the government. And they continue to insist that. That's part of their red herring, in which they continue to insist that Venezuela is propping up Cuba. But they don't talk about the fact that it's also supplying oil to Haiti, to the Dominican Republic, to El Salvador, to Nicaragua, and actually doing something that actually creates a positive for much of the Central American countries and Caribbean countries, for whom oil prices would be extremely onerous, and allows them not to have to negotiate with the IMF and the World Bank, because it gives them much better terms of credit. So, for example, the Dominican Republic receives oil, and in return it gives Venezuela agricultural goods in return for its oil. Cuba, in this case, gave back with supplying medical professionals, who then allowed the Venezuelan government to provide free clinics in most poor neighborhoods who've never seen a doctor, thereby improving the quality of life for the average Venezuelan.
I understand that here in New York State that poor folks are also the beneficiaries of Venezuelan oil with discounted prices for the winter heating.
In Brooklyn and also in Boston, there are programs that the Venezuelan government helps to subsidize through its subsidiary in the U.S., Citgo, which they provide heating oil to poor neighborhoods, poor communities at subsidized prices, to ensure that they have access to heat during the winter months. And this is very much part of the same program in Latin America, in the Caribbean. It's referred to as Petrocaribe. In the U.S., it's a program through existing organizations in which people take an active part, which is also what happens in Venezuela with the social missions that have been used to drop poverty significantly down. Because what people tend to forget is that 1998, Venezuela may have been a major oil exporter, but it also had 60% of people living in poverty. So here was a national discourse that claimed that Venezuela was about to join the first world as a major oil producer, and yet it had this social calamity of having people living in poverty. And much of what's been done in the last 14 years has been an effort to reduce that, and that poverty has been reduced significantly to below 25%, and actually dire poverty has been reduced below 6%. So we see a very wholesale effort at trying to remove inequality, poverty, and not only to do it in Venezuela, but to do it abroad as well.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We're speaking with Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, a professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College, and author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. And Miguel, there's much talk about a regional realignment, post-colonial realignment, among many nations of South America and Central America 1962, following the resurgence of Bolivarismo and the Chavez victory and others similar nearby. Can you tell us what difference this new consciousness in the hemisphere makes, aside from rhetoric, aside from psychology? What are the possible economic implications of continuing along this path, not just economic, but other significant factors?
Well, I think this, you've touched upon them. They are economic, social, cultural, political, and they have really given Latin America a sense of importance and identity at a time in which, as you pointed out, we've really been dealing with post-colonial or neo-colonial relationships. The beginning of this happens in Venezuela, an unlikely place, precisely because Venezuela had been projected and its elites had projected it as a model democracy aligned with the U.S. But Venezuela had a very different internally. There was an imagined Venezuela and a very real other Venezuela comprised of people of color, Afro heritage and indigenous heritage, that really was written out of the national discourse with this whole notion that somehow we, by through miscegenation, we had eliminated social differences and racial differences. And in fact, what we have now is a new identity, not only in Venezuela, but also within Latin America. And that identity is expressed in the fact that you have the very first indigenous president of Bolivia, Evo Morales. You have Rafael Correa in Ecuador. You have, again, social movements and other leaders throughout Latin America, and recognizing the importance of South-South relationships. So here we're talking about the forming of new institutions. I mentioned previously UNASUR, the CELAC, ALBA, which now give voice to Latin America. We have common markets like the Mercosur, which is the common market of South America. And beyond Latin America as a whole, we also have South-South relationships. So for the first time, we have conferences between Latin American leaders and African leaders. We have conferences between Latin American leaders and Middle Eastern and other leaders as well. And a resurgence of relationships in which China plays an important role. So we see a new sense of optimism, a new sense of worth and of importance within Latin America that we would not have seen 15, 20 years ago. If we simply think back to that period, it was a period in which most countries were applying what was at that time called the Washington Consensus, or a series of neoliberal economic policies, read into that austerity, in which poverty had increased, in which inequality had increased, in which crime had increased dramatically as well. So I think there's a new resurgence. Sure, many of the problems continue, but within a different context and within a different political and social and cultural landscape.
On the petroleum front, Venezuela being one of the, if not the major suppliers directly of oil to the United States, there is a great, complexity of relations between Washington and Caracas. And there has been an impulse, not only in this hemisphere, Miguel, but in other parts of the world, certainly in Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi had been moving along with the African Union towards the establishment of an African dinar, where the nation of Iran had made moves to move from the dollar as a basis of oil exports to the euro. And is there a similar economic shaking of the foundations and restructuring of oil transfers and pricing that might have been or might be coming out of Venezuela and its allies?
I think so. If we look at the formation of these institutions I've spoke about recently, for example, within UNASUR, there was the creation of the Bank of the South. The idea here was that this bank would be able to provide loans to member nations at discounted rates without the onerous conditions or preconditions imposed by international lending institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. The same thing would occur within ALBA, which is the Bolivarian Alliance, in which they have actually began using an electronic currency called the Sucre. And in fact, Venezuela and Nicaragua now exchange with an electronic currency that doesn't involve a dollar. And one of Venezuela's early proposals with OPEC was that OPEC should reconsider using the dollar as its currency of choice. And maybe consider other currencies or an electronic currency, so that we see that many of these proposals have included realignment in a recasting of relationships, which on the surface may not seem as important, but the key thing is that they provide more equitable relationships, and they're not constantly dependent on the U.S. as the center of attention, because behind all this is the notion of the importance of creating a multipolar world, one that is not dominated solely by one superpower, but in fact in which allows countries to be able to have sovereignty and to discuss and negotiate on an equal footing with the world powers, and inserts Latin America into a discourse like we saw the case of Brazil with Turkey proposing resolution to the question of Iran nuclear weapons that did not involve sanctions. What we saw with other countries in the regions and their relationship with China. So we see a recasting of relationships, searching for more equitable relations.
With the advent of President Barack Obama, Secretaries of State Hillary Clinton, and certainly now with Secretary John Kerry, has there been any significant change in American policy towards Venezuela since 2008?
Tragically, I would want to say yes, but it hasn't happened. We had as is in the case of Obama, we've seen a lot of promise and very little on the delivery front. We saw Obama candidate in 2008 promise a new relationship with Latin America. And at the Summit of the Americas in 2009, your listeners may recall the meeting with Chavez and Lula and Morales, the various leaders, and Chavez giving Obama a copy of Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins and a discourse that portended the possibility of a new discussion. And shortly thereafter, we saw Obama's return back to a free trade agreement with Colombia. Shortly thereafter, we saw a coup which had the U.S. Support within the OAS against Honduras and the ouster of Manuel Zelaya, the democratic elected president of Honduras. We also saw the continued militarization of the region with U.S. bases in Honduras and El Salvador, in Guantanamo and Cuba, a listening post throughout the Caribbean, an effort to establish 7 different military bases in Colombia that would have given the U.S. overflight capacity over the entire of South America. And we also saw that the Bush-era policy of the U.S. Naval Fourth Fleet in the Caribbean, which many in Latin America, including at that time President Lula, interpreted as simply, again, the U.S. resorting to military tactics in order to impose its will. So although on the surface they may have changed their rhetoric, the reality is that they have actually continued to implement the policy of the Bush-era administration. In fact, their rhetoric is sounding more and more like it. And we still see an effort to try to promote what was the Bush policy, which became the Obama policy. There's a good left and a bad left. The good left is that which is willing to trade with the U.S. The bad left is supposed to be Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia, which has been more critical of the U.S. And they constantly, and the media does this as well, is to equate criticisms of U.S. foreign policy with anti-Americanism, when in fact it is not that. It is the same kind of criticisms that most U.S. citizens have of U.S. policy in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the world, on the world stage. So I think that that's been an unfortunate reality. And instead, we see the Obama administration really pursuing close relationships right now with Mexico, as if Mexico was going to be a model of democracy for the region. And in fact, it has not been seen that, and its record is actually far from it.
There are other elements of United States policy under the Obama administration and administrations before as well that are a bit more clandestine. And that has to do with the election that just took place overnight. And those are the institutions of so-called democratic intervention. We're talking about the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, and others. Can you speak, Miguel Tinker Salas, of the hidden and financial influence of the United States and conservative interests in the Venezuelan election?
Well, we saw that very clearly because in many ways the WikiLeaks reports that have been shown have indicated how the U.S., and in fact one that was revealed less than 2 weeks ago, in which at that time the ambassador to the to Venezuela from the U.S. was talking about the need to try to undermine support for Chavez, the need to actually fund these so-called non-governmental organizations that were supposed to be promoting voter involvement and voter engagement and citizen engagement, and this entire discourse, and he talks openly about funding these organizations with the goal of subverting the Chavez administration, with turning its supporters against him. And on a more broader scale, the WikiLeaks reports have also indicated, through the cables that were released about the U.S. Embassy in Chile and Brazil and others, is that the way that they have tried to isolate Venezuela within Latin America, their strategy was to immunize Latin America against Venezuela, as if somehow Venezuela had a pathogen, and this notion of citizens' power was that pathogen. And they've actually tried to create support, they thought, within the Brazilian military, and that backfired, or try to create support within other militaries in the region to counterpose one country against the other, so that we've seen a concerted effort, not only on the public record, but within the record that was revealed as a result of WikiLeaks, support for non-governmental organizations with the intent of subverting the power in the country, financing it, funding it. We also saw meetings with the opposition. Clearly in the 2002 coup, there was an upcoming, there were meetings with the opposition to plan strategy. There is some evidence that those have continued as well. So we see an actual set of policies implemented by both Bush and Obama to actually attempt to undermine democratically elected governments in the region.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight, speaking with Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College. And one ultimate question for you, Miguel, is this. Do you think that with the apparent continuity of the Chavez movement in Venezuela and the regional Bolivarian movement, that following this election, that Venezuela will be able to export democracy, as it were?
Well, I think that the model that we see of citizen participation, of social participation, of addressing inequality, of addressing poverty, of allocating important national resources, like Venezuela has done, over 60% increase to the allocation of social programs and to improve the quality of life for the average Venezuelan, has had an echo throughout Latin America. We see that Latin Americans as a whole have made an important effort to reduce poverty and inequality, a legacy of the neoliberal economic policies that were adopted in the 80s and 90s. And that's part of what people tend to forget in terms of why these leaders came to power. They came to power precisely because of the levels of inequality. They came to power because citizens organized into social movements, into organizations, into community networks, and demanded a presence, because people of African heritage and indigenous heritage who had been written out of the national narrative demanded a presence within the new national discourse. So I think that Venezuela is not trying to export anything. These social processes that happen as a result of individual countries and contradictions, but it does stand as a model of what can be done, and I think that's what most people fear. And unfortunately, if the U.S. media is your only source of information, it's very difficult to understand. The U.S. commercial media, it's very difficult to understand what actually is transpiring in Latin America. And to me, it is in many ways an Arab Spring, except that we don't call it an Arab Spring, because in Washington and other places, they see it as somehow subverting U.S. presence in the region, because we're so used to seeing Latin America as the U.S.'s backyard, as the U.S.'s area of domination. And these changes tend to perturb Washington and economic interests.
Miguel, I leave you the floor for any additional comments you might wish to add, and to tell people how they might follow your work.
Well, I think that the challenges in Venezuela are real. I think the new Maduro administration recognizes it. I think they will have to move quickly to try to resolve some of these issues and to have a very positive agenda and to try to bring this country together in ways that we've seen already beginning to happen. I think this election demonstrates also that there are important differences, and the way to resolve them is through the democratic process. And I think that's what happened yesterday, was a democratic process, a transparent democratic process. Democracy is precisely what we saw yesterday. A victory in Venezuela, even if it's close, is no different than a victory in the U.S. or a victory anywhere else. And I think the U.S. has to recognize that. The countries of Latin America have begun to recognize it already. Argentina, Brazil, the Union of South American Nations. And they will all be present for the inauguration of the new president. Anyone interested in following my work can actually go to my webpage, www.migueltinkersalas.com, and see my publications, and also send me an email.
Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College, and the author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. Thank you so much for such an informative encounter on this election day.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
And that concludes today's 5 o'clock shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Sean Rhodes. We welcome your comments, questions, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.